Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to the Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network, powered by the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity Segment, TotalTutor.net for more information, Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, SimplyG.com, and also you can check out BeachLifestyle.com, and I'm really excited. I have been asking for this. I was in negotiations with another star from Dancing with the Stars, and it was a no-go. So I'm like, I'm giving up and saying, it's never going to happen. But a good friend of mine, one of the publicists I've worked with before, has pulled through. So I want to welcome the program, Dancing with the Stars celebrity, star of Dancing with the Stars, Sharna Burgess. Sharna, thanks for calling.
No problem. It's wonderful to have a chat with you.
Oh, I'm excited to talk with you, and it's just absolutely amazing to think, again, to hear the word celebrity, because it's amazing how popular Dancing with the Stars is, not just the stars, but also the dancers who are celebrities themselves. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, my God. It's incredible. This show has been going on 17 seasons now, and the longest-standing pros on the show truly have as big a fan base sometimes as the celebrities that come on. And I think it's just such a fantastic thing that dance has been able to do that for people, because generally dancers are in the background. And so it's really wonderful that it's given an opportunity for dancers to stand forward and really showcase their talent.
That's so true, and my mother-in-law is one of the biggest fans of Dancing with the Stars. So I wouldn't say been forced to watch it with my wife, but whenever she's over, she's like, "We're putting this on." And I was just amazed at the growth and where it's gone. And I think it's really brought a love of dance back to a lot of dances that really people wouldn't have thought about before. The traditional dances have come back for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, I grew up as a ballroom dancer, and it certainly wasn't the coolest dance style to be doing. You know, ballroom was really seen as what your grandparents did. And something that Dancing with the Stars has done is really show the people in our audience how modern it is and how much it's evolved and how influenced it is by other styles, especially today. You can really see sometimes a hip-hop edge or a contemporary edge to a lot of the choreography we do on the show. And I think it's so wonderful that Dancing with the Stars has been able to showcase that and introduce people into this dance style that really is cool, you know, and really is a lot of fun, and it's had America fall in love with it. So it's a really, really cool thing.
Well, absolutely, Sharna, and it's something that it's so real in so many ways, and now finally your sport is just on the map. Everyone talks about it, and again, I know it's not easy, okay, because I remember they're seeing always the stars trying to train for this, and if they don't have a dancing background at all, it takes lots of hard work and discipline to be a successful dancer, and you see it from the judges' tips to how you guys dance, that you really have to train a lot, don't you?
Oh, my goodness, yes. I mean, these celebrities right now are in about 5 to 6 hour days most of the time. Last season, they actually cut us back. Last season, we were doing 8 hours a day,
Wow.
Because it really does take that much time. You know, you have to learn baby steps. You have to learn the foundation. Even sometimes you look at dance and you think, I could do that. But what you don't understand is what it takes to be able to do that. It's not a case of mimicking. It's having to understand the fundamentals and the basics of being able to do the move. And it's so much training to teach a celebrity how to do that. So you really see incredible growth in them from the start of the show to the end of it, especially when they make it to the finale. Rob Kardashian was a great example of that. He started out as hopeless with two left feet, and he made it to the finale and was actually decent. You know what I mean? He had rhythm. He was moving. He was grooving. He was doing great. He was performing. Cheryl did a really wonderful job that season of teaching him.
You really see that you guys have to be teachers as well. And, Sharna, that goes back to, again, I guess, whoever taught you dance, how you see that you develop that love of dancing through great teachers. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, absolutely. Your teacher, your coach is everything, especially when you're a kid and you're growing up and you're dancing and they're nurturing you. Not only do they have to really hone in the fundamentals and the technique of everything and make you a serious dancer, but they have to let you explore your love for it creatively and find who you are creatively. It's an art teaching. Not everybody who dances can teach. you know, it's certainly its own skill set and its own talent, so to speak. Being able to have that language as a teacher to get through to a student, especially in dance, can really be quite difficult. So but everybody on Dancing with the Stars does it brilliantly, and that's why we're all there.
So you wouldn't be able to make it through the casting call, would you, if you could not have patience and teach well? Because these celebrities are probably difficult to coach at times, aren't they?
Oh, they can be. You know, they're under a lot of stress and they're fatigued. There's a lot going on. The whole of America's watching them, and they don't want to mess up and they don't want to be made a fool of. You know, there's a lot of pressure on them, and so it does set the, you know, meltdown moments and frustration and attitude and all those sorts of things, which are very, very normal when you're working so closely together. But you really, when it comes to Dancing with the Stars, we have to play best friend, we have to play dance coach, we have to play, you know, everything. The shoulder to cry on when things are really tough. We have to be that everything person for them through those 10 weeks. So it's as grueling for the celebs as it is for the pros.
It seems like it. It's making me, when I see this, I couldn't imagine trying to train for this. And like you said, tell us your regimen off season, meaning not during Dancing with the Stars. How many hours do you train a day to keep the shape that you're in and the endurance and the ability to perform like this?
Today, I do so much more choreography in the hiatus for us, more so than dance. So for me, I like to go to hot yoga to keep fit and take dance class when I can. But my time is really spent with creating choreography, creating concepts and putting treatments together for the different projects that I have going on. So I definitely need to do the additional exercise in the off season to make sure I stay fit.
When you are always performing, do you have to do as much training during the day or limited because it's so exhausting?
When I was dancing every day and I was, a full-out dancer on tour, the whole thing, I didn't have to do anything else. You know, that was pretty much all I needed to do. There was so much dancing. I remember when I was on tour with a show called Burn the Floor, we were on Broadway, and it was the most incredible but also the most tiring experience of my life. We were doing 6 to 8 hour rehearsal days through the day, and then we would have to do our full 2 hour show at night in front of a live audience because we were going under so much construction for the show in the beginning of the run. So I had never known tired and I had never known sore before that time in my life. It was just absolutely incredible. But it was the love for dance and the love for Broadway that everybody pulled together on, and really every show was incredible. But the thought of going to the gym when I had time off made me want to be sick a little bit. I was like, no, I need my time. I need to recover. So I'd chill out, I think, on days off. But, today, I don't do as much full-out dancing in the hiatus as I do when I'm on the show. So I have to balance it with other things.
Exactly. And we're talking to Sharna Burgess again, the dancer from Dancing with the Stars. And we're learning about her regiment, her training, and you're listening to the Toll Education Network. And I'm really enjoying the conversation because, again, people don't know how much time and how much. But if you would take a look at pictures of you and see how great of shape you're in, dancers really have to be. And I'm going to go into kind of question because my two daughters dance. I have three daughters. And yep. They're both dancers. One's 8 and the other one's 4. When did you finally see that this is a gift of yours and that you can kind of make this a profession for yourself? When did you finally really understand that? Because, look, think at how many girls dance. Tons.
Many girls. I mean, growing up as a kid, all the kids in my neighborhood were in dance, basically, you know, to entertain and learn to move and socialize. And I think it's a wonderful thing for kids. I went really hardcore into competing in ballroom from when I was about 12 years old. I went and represented Australia at the World Championships when I was 15. But I unfortunately busted my knee and had a knee reconstruction, which put me off the floor eventually for 2 years. And it wasn't really until the end of those 2 years where I had missed it so much. And I wasn't expressing myself creatively the way that I needed to. And I was very frustrated and, you know, just feeling a little bit lost and not myself. And I realized it's dance. You know, that was finally the point in my life where the decision was mine. It wasn't my parents. I wasn't young and they were putting me in it because I was good at it. I was an adult and it was my decision that this wasn't any longer a choice. It was something I had to do for my own sanity because it was where I was exactly meant to be. And so I packed my bags and I moved to London at 18 years old and trained over there with the world champions at the time. And 2 years after that, I was going on tour. So from the minute I realized that it was like fast track into the industry, but it really wasn't until later in life. I was 18.
How competitive is it just to go into traveling and being a professional in this? How competitive of casting is this and stuff to continue to be a professional dancer, especially on the circuit?
Well, in the industry, it's very difficult as a ballroom dancer because there's very minimal work, you know, if you want to do that. There's Dancing with the Stars, there's a couple of other things, and every now and then commercials come around that want ballroom dancers, but for the most part, it's commercial dancers. And really today, and something that I've had to do in the last, say, 8 years of my life, is adapt to other styles and not just be one thing. You have to be a hybrid of everything. So I've, you know, gone in and taken class and learned everything and educated myself as a dancer to be versatile and to be able to do other things to work in this industry. Unfortunately, if you are just one style of dancer today, you will not get as much work as the person standing next to you. And that's something that anybody that is trying to be a dancer in this industry should know. You have to put your foot into everything and try and master as much as you can.
Being a celebrity show, and we really wanted to add some education portions to it because especially about, again, you're educating people in so many ways about ballroom dancing and about dancing in general. Your experiences on Dancing with the Stars, that must have been so real to have the cameras rolling, to be working with these celebrities and really be the boss because you have to tell these people what to do and they're so high profile in so many ways.
Yeah, it's it is interesting. I think some pros that come onto it maybe get a little taken back by having the cameras in the room all the time and whatnot. I was very lucky to have worked so much in the industry before I came to Dancing with the Stars, so it didn't really freak me out and it didn't play on my mind at all. I just came in, do my job, and I know what the cameras need when they need it. When we need to do interviews, I understand the process, so it didn't frazzle me at all, but it can be quite overwhelming, I think, for some people when you walk into that job and there's all of a sudden cameras on you the whole time. You have a celebrity that might be really insecure and a little bit difficult. You've got to think of everything on the spot and on camera. You know, there's no time on your own to figure it out. You have to do it right there and then. And, you know, that's why we have seen pros in the past come for one season and then go because it's not for everybody. It's a lot to take in. But I had already choreographed on the film. I'd already done commercials. I'd already toured and done many things. So I was very lucky to have that education. It certainly helped me going into the show.
So that was the reality portion of this. A lot of these dancers get involved saying, I'm going to go on a TV show. But this is a reality show. They're not just going to show the performance that takes 3 minutes. They're going to show your whole relationship with your partner and what you go
exactly
through, the ups and downs, and some of it's too difficult for some people because this is real. This is reality.
Exactly.
And I don't, and they think that, oh yeah, they'll kind of cut these things out, and that's not the case at all, is it?
You know, no, that's not the case at all. If you have a fight, they are going to cut that out. They're going to use it. You know, if there's an injury, they're going to use it. You know, and like I said, there's eyes on you the entire time, and I don't think that people realize that, how much goes into it and how you are truly filmed every second you're with your celebrity. And it's something that people should know when they come into the show, for sure.
Well, they need to watch all reality television to finally find that out. Like, specifically, my good relationship with a lot of Real Housewives and other people that have been on reality TV shows, they've really taught me the what really goes on. And guess what? You got to be watching because these producers are looking for what's hot, what's going to be interesting. So you have to really keep your poise. And were you coached at all to told, you know, you got to watch Sharna, what you do, because you could really end up on the news in many ways, right? That to kind of not to really calm down and make sure you're going to vent later on, not on camera.
Yeah, it's It's an interesting thing. I mean, I had Andy Dick for my first season as pro. And going into it, I was like, oh, my goodness, those cameras are on us all the time. What is going to happen? What disaster are we going to have? But he was wonderful. He was sober through the entire season and the whole time we're working together. And he is actually such a wonderful man underneath his horrible addiction problem. And we had an amazing journey. But there are times when I think I'm aware of it, so I check myself. It's like, okay, deep breath, take it in, talk about it later, and don't do it on camera because you don't want that scene. And the problem is you have so many hours through the entire week of working on that number. You are guaranteed going to have a frustrating moment, possibly a little argument, but for the majority it could be good. But if the producers want to pick, to play it to the audience as an argument and a bad week, they can't. So you really have to watch the way you behave in your rehearsals and always keep it fun, always keep it light, always keep it firm and serious, but try not to get too aggressive with it or too out of line, so to speak. But it is difficult because when you're in the middle of it, you forget the cameras are there and you just need to get out of them what you need. You know, so you push them really hard and sometimes it can be too far. It's really finding each celebrity's limit too.
Okay, Sharna, anything else, any other projects up coming up that you want to promote and specifically any of your other brands? What would you like to promote?
I've got lots of stuff coming up, actually. I'm choreographing with Paul Kirkland, another choreographer and dancer in the industry for Strictly Come Dancing, happening at the beginning of December, which is the English Dancing with the Stars, which is amazing. We also have a production that we're putting together that should be running in Atlantic City for March for 3 months, which will just be like an hour show at one of the casinos there. Lots and lots of stuff going on. I'm also doing Ballroom with a Twist through February, I think, and I'm doing the Dancing with the Stars cruise in January. So anyone that wants to come check it out and go to the Bahamas for a little bit should come and do the Dancing with the Stars cruise.
Oh, wow, you have a lot going on, so I'm excited about
how busy,
but we're going to have you back on in about 3 months to update us on what's the latest things going on with Sharna. So where can we find information on you and learn more about you?
Well, I have a website, which is at sharnaburgess.com, and I am on pretty much every social media outlet you can find, for Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Pinterest. There's something else, I'm pretty sure of it, but it's all at Sharna Burgess.
Well, we'll have to go check it out. I saw the website's really nice, and best of luck to you, and I hope that, again, next year in Dancing with the Stars, we'll have you on before to preview everything, but we'll definitely stay in touch, and best of luck to you, and thanks for calling.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the chat.
All right, take care, Sharna. Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye.
You're listening to Toll Education Celebrity Show, powered by the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity Segment. We'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Toll Education Celebrity Show on the Toll Education Network, powered by the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity Segment, TollTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TollTutor Neil S. Haley. Facebook, also BeachLifestyle.com and SimplyG.com. And I'm really excited to welcome the program United States two-time Olympian figure skater Michael Weiss. Michael, thanks for calling.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
We're excited to talk to you. And I tell you, it's always, especially when you're doing such great things in the community, we're going to definitely talk about that and how you're raising money and different things. But let's talk about your career first. Michael, did you always want to be a figure skater? Was that something that you always wanted to do when you were a kid?
Not really. Actually, I come from a pretty interesting background as far as my family goes. My dad was a gymnast. Actually, he was in the Olympics back in 1964 in gymnastics. And my mom was also a national champion in gymnastics. And then I have two older sisters. And they were in, one of them was a world junior champion in platform diving, you know, like Greg Louganis and the 10-meter platforms. And then my other sister was a junior national champion in figure skating. So it was like I was always in either gymnastics, diving, or figure skating growing up. And my middle sister, basically I went to the rink with her when I was about 9 years old, after being a diver before. I was a diver early on, and then I said, you know what, I'm gonna go to the rink with my other sister and check that sport out. I went, and I started picking stuff up relatively quickly, and the coaches kind of gave me a lot of praise because I was picking stuff up fast. And, you know, as a 9-year-old, a 10-year-old, you think that's kind of cool. So that's kind of how I got started in figure skating, and then the rest, you know, as they say, is history.
Well, most definitely, and I guess when you're growing up in such a competitive family, all the you were bred for this, Michael.
Yeah, I was. Like I guess my parents were both gymnasts themselves. Then they actually started a gymnastics school and taught over in Silver Spring, Maryland area when I was younger. So I kind of grew up in the gym, you know, with other gymnasts all around me. So it was some sort of flipping, twisting, or spinning sport that I was going to be involved in. It was just a matter of choosing which one.
Well, absolutely. And I guess, and I'm sure that your family was able to give you a lot of advice in competition to know ultimately, and that might have definitely been a help. We look at research of like, celebrities' children, if they go into sports, how they most likely are going to have a good success, because it's not always your athletic ability. It's also the it's also your mental capacity. How do you handle adversity? How do you handle the competition? Do you get the right amount of rest? Look at the Mannings. I mean, who would have Archie Manning thought that he'd have his sons would be better quarterbacks than he was? You know, and went further and to that high level. So let's go specifically, Michael, how you got involved in the figure skating game. So basically you were saying that you look like you're going to be a gymnast, but who kind of got you involved in the figure skating?
Well, I started out as in diving. Like I said, I kind of grew up in the gym initially, but never really took to that. Then I went to diving actually with my oldest sister. And I was a regional champion when I was like 7, 8 in that range years old. And then basically I just kind of, you know, I wasn't into it. I'm like, you know, this isn't my thing. I want to try something different. And my other sister had been a skater and started skating, and she was already kind of at the regional level. And so my mom said, basically, let's go to the rink and try skating and see if you like it. Tried on a pair of skates the first day, and I was actually pretty bad initially. And my skating coach, who later on became my skating coach, Audrey Whisker, took me to two Olympic Games. But when she first saw me, she said, she said jokingly, she's like, all right, he's not going to be the skater in the family. Talking more about my sister, like my sister was the talented one. I wasn't going to be the skater in the family. Kind of poking fun at my ability the first time on the ice. But then I picked things up quickly. You know, within a week or so, I started to get comfortable on my feet. Within a year, I was, competing on a regional level. And it was something that I didn't take to right away. But when I did start to get the hang of it, following my sister's footsteps, she was, like I said, a great skater. She was a junior national champion as well. So I was always kind of Jeremy is her name. I was always kind of Jeremy's little brother until probably the age of, I'd say, maybe 14, 15 when I started to make a name for myself on the national level.
Interesting. So they really didn't expect you to be as good as your sister. So you're sitting here, you're sitting here in the back seat. And it's amazing, Michael, I've been talking to a lot of Olympians. We're creating this segment. We're finding out most of them that have had success to become Olympians, no one gave them a chance. Because again, it's something like, oh, you know, you're not going to be the one. No, someone else is going to be. So, and the amount of time you have to put into the gym, and now, I mean the ice rink now, but the amount of time you have to put in, does it help that your mom and dad did the same thing when they grew up and they kind of gave you some advice of how to handle that and train right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, it's hard for some parents if you haven't been involved in a sport or athletics before to kind of be able to relate to, you know, getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning when you don't want to and, you know, skating before school and then, you know, having to miss some school activities in order to go to skating competitions nationally and, you know, what it's like to fall on an element, you know, 500 times before you ever successfully do it. I mean, it's, you know, you can kind of try and relate to it, but there's a different level of understanding if a parent has already done that. You know, my parents had already gone through that, you know, making their own Olympic teams, and they know what it's like to come home sore and tired and you know, let down at a really disappointing competition. And they see those things, and they're able to, you know, help you because of their experience, give you a little bit of insight on how to deal with that. And I also think it's an expectation level, too. Like, I have kids now who are 14 and 15, and I believe, my wife and I believe that it's an expectation that you set for your kids. You know, if you're expected to get good grades and be successful in athletics, you set that standard for them, and they naturally go after it and achieve it. And they may fall short here and there, and then they may overachieve sometimes. But you know, there's a standard that you set, being a parent that's done it before. And that's important, and you have to be there for your kids. And myself going through it again with my kids, I can relate more to what it's like to come home sore and tired and not want to go out there and do that extra workout. But that's what you got to do if you want to be, if you want to be the best at what you do.
All right, we're talking to Michael Weiss, two-time Olympian, and we're learning that, again, people weren't giving him a shot. His family were probably like, okay, Michael, I guess you're not going to be one of our world-class athletes. And then, I guess, were you a late bloomer when finally 14 and 15 you started winning competitions and people said, hey, you might be something now?
Yeah, I think it was more like right when I first started getting on the ice is when people were kind of thinking, all right, he doesn't have the natural skating ability that say my sister had. But then within a year, I started to get the hang of it. But literally till I was 14, 15 is until I really started to realize that this was something that, you know, maybe I could make a career at and be one of the best skaters in the world. And I think that's when my first international competition really was when I was able to gauge myself. And I knew that I was kind of good at a regional level and even maybe, on the East Coast. But I was like, okay, what does that really mean as far as the Olympics go? You know, so I'm good on the East Coast of the United States. There's the whole rest of the world I got to compete against. So I went to my first international competition in Seoul, Korea, when I was 16. And I placed second against the best skaters from all the other countries, from Russia and China and Japan. And then that's kind of when I realized and mentally kind of flicked the switch for me. And I was like, okay, if I'm one of the best junior skaters in the world, if I continue working hard and continue on this path, I could potentially be one of the best skaters in the world. And so that's kind of when it really flicked the switch for me and everybody started kind of taking notice of what I could do.
And the amount of training, once you knew you were at that point, must have been crazy, right? The amount of training right after you the World Championships, and you see that you have the potential to be in the Olympics. You have a chance to be a great Olympian.
Right.
So then, did your training even get stepped up even further after that?
Yeah, that's the point where I ended up taking over. When you're younger and you're an athlete, I'm not sure if, you said you talked to a number of different Olympians. There's usually somebody when they're younger, that's the driving force in their life, that continues to put, because no 12-year-old wants to get up before school and go to the ice rink, in 30 degrees and practice. But somebody's there to do it because they know that if they want to be an Olympian, that's what they have to do. And so there's somebody there helping them along. And then like I said, a switch turns on, and you end up taking over the steering wheel and driving and being like, okay, this is what I want to do. I know I want to be an Olympian now. And I know what it takes to get there, and that means, getting up and working and doing the things I don't want to do in order to get the things that I do want. And that's kind of what I talk about. I talked about the discipline that kind of took over for me as a 16-year-old. I said, okay, I don't want to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. I don't want to work out 6 hours a day, 6 days a week. But I do want to be a national champion and a world champion and an Olympic champion. I want to be those things, so I got to do the things I don't want to do in order to get the things I do want. And that's kind of the route that I took, where I just started taking over my my training. And I had a great support group around me too, with my parents, my sisters. I had great coaches around me to help support. But at some point, as an athlete, you got to take over and decide this is what I want to do. And about 16 is when I took over.
So you took over at 16, and before you know it, you're just competing and doing very well. And tell us about how you got into the Olympics for your first Olympics. What happened, the process and all this stuff? Did they think you would end up in there, or was it what was happening?
It's one of those, with me particularly, it was a steady climb. Achieved some success at the junior ranks, junior world championships. I was the world junior champion at age 17. Then I turned to the senior ranks, which are the people that go to the Olympics. And so for a few years, I really kind of had to establish myself and find out what type of skater it was that I was going to be. And then in 1998 was the national championships. And I had placed second at the national championships the year before. So the top two go to the Olympics, and this was, so I was kind of positioned well to go to the Olympics. I was ranked number two in the country, the top two go, and I was, the national championships are our Olympic trials. So I competed in Philadelphia, actually. Philadelphia at, well, the name of that arena has changed a lot. Sometimes it's Comcast Center, First Union Center. It's a different name all the time, but that the arena where the Flyers play was the Olympic trials, and so I went out and skated one of the best programs of my entire life and ended up making that first Olympic team and going to Nagano, Japan to represent the United States. And luckily enough, 4 years later, the United States, the Olympics were in the United States in Salt Lake City in 2002. And I was fortunate enough to continue throughout that 4 years and make that Olympic team and have competed at an Olympics, not only in the United States in Salt Lake City, in my hometown country, but also in 1998 in Japan was where the Olympics that my dad competed in. So I went to Japan where my dad competed in the Olympics and then was able to have a hometown Olympics in the USA too. So I was very fortunate to not only make the teams, but make them in pretty cool places.
All right, when we get back, we're going to go right into specifically, I guess, life after the Olympics, how you are, you know, you can't take away you're an Olympian, Michael. You can't, that not many people could say that name. So that's a key thing that leads you to opportunity, what you truly love about the sport, and how you can help others. Because once you have that name status, once you have that celebrity status, you can help others, lead them to the next level. So when we get back, more with Michael Weiss, two-time Olympian figure skater. You're listening to Toll Education Celebrity Show on the Toll Education Network, powered by the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity Segment. And we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Toll Education Celebrity Show on the Toll Education Network, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, The Beach Lifestyle Celebrity Segment, again, SimplyG.com, BeachLifestyle.com. And I'm with Michael Weiss, two-time Olympian figure skater, and an interesting story so far. You are an Olympian, two-time. What do you do after when you're ready to move on? You've accomplished many different things in your career. What do you do next? And that life after figure skating, that's got to be tough for any Olympic athlete.
Yeah, the transition for me was, I was fortunate enough when figure skating was very popular because of the whole Tonya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan incident. Yeah. That occurred, and all of a sudden figure skating was thrown into the spotlight. There were a lot of opportunities as far as touring and performing go. I toured with Champions on Ice for 8 years, and we toured all around the U.S. And then I toured with Smucker's Stars on Ice for another 8 years after that. So I was able to tour and make money while I was competing, and then also when I was done competing, I went with Stars on Ice, and I was able to tour and provide for my family and open up some other doors and opportunities as well through commentating. I'm doing commentating for NBC Sports for the next generation of competitors. And so it's been a great ride competitively, but also, you know, after competition, it's been quite a journey as well. I've had a lot of opportunities to travel the world, travel the country, and then also I started the Michael Weiss Foundation not too long ago. We're coming up on our ninth year in having it, and we award scholarships to the next generation of up-and-coming skaters because, you know, my family struggled financially to keep me in figure skating, and so I always said if I ever reached a point where, you know, where I could make enough money and make enough connections and resources so that I could give back to another up-and-coming skater, that I would, and that's kind of how my foundation started. And we've helped a ton of young athletes achieve their dreams as Olympians as well.
Well, Michael, I think it's fantastic to know, again, your sport. Figure skating is one that you guys can become professionals after your career as Olympic athletes. A lot of Olympic athletes aren't able to do that in track and field and have those opportunities, and you guys have those opportunities to make money. And I guess you're right, figure skating became very popular after Nancy Kerrigan and all that, but it seems still very, very popular. We're talking the Winter Olympics. We're going to watch figure skating as one of the biggest thing coming out. So you you really took the bull by the horns. I mean, you said, I'm going to take this and go on further and move on and be successful. But when the foundation, that's tremendous that you want to give back. You're looking at helping others. So you saw your parents struggle. They weren't to spend that kind of money.
Yeah.
Explain to people how expensive it is to compete as an Olympic athlete, especially when you don't have sponsorship or anything. You just have to keep going.
Yeah, well, specifically in figure skating, you know, my parents, even, you know, back when I was growing up, they were spending $40,000 and $50,000 a year on my skating expenses.
Wow.
And now those numbers are even higher. You know, skaters are now expected to have, you know, an overall coach. Then they have a spin coach and a jump coach and a choreographer. And they have skating costume designers and they have off-ice trainers. And they have, you know, the list goes on and on as far as their expenses go. And I just saw a number of kids that have a ton of talent and the drive to become, you know, an Olympic champion, but they didn't have the resources. You know, their parents, you know, may not be making the amount of money that can support $50,000 a year in training expenses. So I didn't want those kids to be limited and not be able to achieve and go after their goals without, you know, the financial help and support they needed. And that was the motivation for starting the foundation. And since then, we've awarded over $500,000 in skating scholarships to up-and-coming athletes. And even we started, Mariah Nagasu was in the last Olympics in Vancouver, and she was one of the athletes that we helped at a young age at 12, 13 years old. And she went on to place fourth at the Olympics in Vancouver. So these skaters have worked their tail off and gotten a lot of support from their coaches, coaching staff, and like that. But we give them a little bit of extra money to make sure that they have what they need so that they can prepare for the Olympic Games without having to worry about making ends meet. They got enough to worry about when you're trying to win an Olympic medal or make an Olympic team. So we do what we can to award financial scholarships for them. And through such, we've been able to get sponsorship as well. Smucker sponsors the foundation. Musselman's has started to sponsor the foundation as well, and Pandora. So if we can use those types of companies to give money and support my foundation, then automatically that money goes right into the pockets
That's
of the
great.
Skaters so that they can be the next generation of champions for the United States.
So, Michael, it's amazing to hear, especially with your career, how you went and stepped up. You said, I want to keep this sport going. I want to see the people like myself get an opportunity. You could just continue to just be a professional and until you're retired and be done with it and, you know, and do some commentating. But you decided to come up and start this foundation. And how many people once you said you were going to do this? Said, are you really going to do this? I've not heard of people doing this, right? Am I correct?
Yeah. Not a lot of figure skaters do it. I mean, I was the first one to start a foundation that helped actually support, you know, the next generation. And the thing is that all the skaters that I have, we have a fundraising event once a year. It's usually held in September, down in the Washington, D.C. area. And, you know, every time we have this show, I invite all the best skaters in the world. You know, Brian Boitano, Christy Yamaguchi, Katia Gordieva, like all the former champions along with current champions, and they all donate their time. They all skate in the show so that every dime raised goes right to the next generation. And a lot of the skaters are willing to do so because they were in that situation before. Most of them did struggle growing up, and their family did struggle paying for their training expenses. So they've been so supportive. Without the skaters, I wouldn't have been able to pull it off. And the show that we have is a fun, family-oriented show. Everybody donates their time, from the ice rink donating their time to the chairs on the ice donated, to the lighting donated, to the, you know, to the food at the reception afterward donated, so that all the expenses are so minimal that that every single dime that we raise in ticket sales and sponsorship goes right out to the skaters. And that was really my intention, to get as much back to them as possible. And we've been doing it successfully for 9 years now.
When you're bringing these type of players, skaters, into this event, this has got to be a hot ticket. You're telling me these names that are involved in raising money. And how difficult was it to kind of gather them all together? Or was it an easy process to get all these?
Well,
go ahead.
It started out as more as a, as like, hey, like as a friend favor. You know, I'd ask me about it. Look, I'm putting together this show in a couple months, and I need you guys to come. That's basically what it is. Like, look, I'm gonna probably get some flight miles donated from some people who are supporting the foundation. I'll donate some of my own miles to fly you guys out here. We're all gonna stay at my house. I'm not gonna. I don't want a hotel bill. So literally, that's what the sales pitch was. We're gonna have a big party at our house, and we're gonna do a show over the course of the weekend, and people are gonna love it. They're gonna buy tickets, and we're gonna raise money. And that's what it is. We had I had 18 people staying at my house back in September when we just had the show. So that's what it was. Everybody come over. We'll hang out, have a good time. The next day, we'll skate a great show and raise some money for the next generation, and then fly you out, and you'll be on your way. And that's usually a tough sell. Like, hey, guys, I want you all to come in and skate for free. But everybody's been willing to do it. They've all stepped up to the plate year after year. And it's become kind of a tradition, you know, the my generation of, you know, Todd Eldridge and Yuka Sato and Brian Wakano, those people have all been supportive right from the start. And that's why the foundation has been a success.
Well, Michael, you have to be very happy with your success as an Olympian athlete, then now involved with the foundation and also working for NBC. I mean, it just must be so amazing to now, again, coming up to the next Olympics, to be able to be involved in all this in so many ways, to cover it and to be part of Olympic figure skating history. In so many ways, to some of the things you're doing. You must be so impressed and humbled in certain aspects to think about where you came from to where you are today.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that's been so enjoyable for me is, you know, skating, as much as it's, you know, just the actual medals go and all that, that's nice. But the things that you learn and the opportunities I've been given through the sport have just been, you know, like a dream come true. It sounds like such a cliche, but, you know, at a young age, when I started at 9 years old, I would have never thought that I would become a figure skater or a professional figure skater or be involved in the sport as long as I have. And now to look back on everything and realize that, you know, I did what I loved for so long and I'm still enjoying it is pretty cool.
So, Michael, do you have any other projects coming up in the near future? Always people that are, they have their own brand like you have. There's got to be other things going on with you, isn't there?
Well, we have, I'm doing a number of shows that are going to air on NBC. Distance Skating is putting on the Pandora Skating Series. So in November, there's going to be on NBC. I'm co-hosting some shows with Chris Yamaguchi and then also actually performing in them as well. And one of them is November 2nd at Penn State University. We're having a show there. My daughter is a singer, and she sings. She wrote her first original, and so she's going to be singing her first original song, and I'm going to be performing to it. And Sarah Evans is going to be performing live, and Christy Yamaguchi, and a whole great cast of skaters. So that's the first of an entire series of four different shows that'll televised in November and December and January on NBC.
All right. So also remember, the Pittsburgh fans are not far from Penn State. So my Pittsburgh listeners should go check it out for sure. All right. That's awesome. And I think especially you're doing a lot for sure, Michael. I appreciate you definitely taking the time. Where do you see yourself in the next 10 years in this sport? Where do you want to see yourself, place yourself in the next 10 years? Where do you think? With all the different things you're doing?
I think I would like to continue to grow the foundation and continue to support figure skating. Certainly be involved on the commentary side with, you know, it's a lot. I always joked about it. It's, you know, I always used to listen to Dick Button and Scott Hamilton to commentate me on TV. And I was like, oh, I could, you know, like they made a mistake saying this or that. And then you realize when you actually do it yourself, you're like, okay, it's a lot harder than it looks. Now, having done it myself, you know, all the things that are going through your mind when a skater is skating, you're trying to analyze everything. And you may be thinking about one thing and you say another. And so I have a lot of respect for what they've done over the years. And hopefully I can be in those shoes and commentate for Olympics in the future.
Well, we'll definitely have to have you back on to promote your next event, meaning in September for next year's foundation, and kind of promote it, all the people that will be attending, and help you in that process. I appreciate you definitely coming by the show. And interesting, Michael, so many different things going on, definitely a jack of all trades. You really have done everything you can to help the figure skating community. And I know when I'm listening to the Olympics, I'll be like, when watching the Olympics, I'll say, hey, I interviewed Michael. Pretty cool. You know, it's funny when I interview all these Olympians, it seems like a blur, but then I'm saying, well, that's why I like to talk to you, not just about the foundations, to learn more about you and what you're doing and your passion. And that usually leads to why you did the foundation. And that's why I try to bring that, this platform on this radio program, to promote foundations are truly helping others. So where can we, our listeners, find information and donate to the foundation and learn more about you, Michael?
My website, michaelweiss.org is my website. And we have information there on how you can make a donation to the foundation, and information on our 10th annual Ice Champions Live, which is my Michael Weiss Foundation fundraiser. That'll be held in September of next year. So all the information will be on there. It'll be another great show, and we'll be raising some more money.
All right, we'll have to reach out to you in the summer to have you back on to talk about the event and everything. So it was good talking to you, and best of luck. You're doing some fantastic things. Thanks for calling, Michael.
Great. Thank you for having me.
All right, take care. Okay, bye-bye. You're listening to the Toll Education Celebrity Show on the Toll Education Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Tutor Show on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net, and it's the Insightful Players series. And oh my gosh, I cannot wait always to have the Insightful Players. They're so fantastic. And what Insightful Player has done is they're partnering with the NFL, who are great role models to empower youth. The NFL players are featured in her book, with even more stories at insightfulplayer.com. This is Chrissy Carew, who's doing fantastic things, and she's going to offer educational programs, including school assemblies. And today's Insightful Player, again, being this is a Pittsburgh station, our flagship, they're not going to be as happy till they get to meet this guy, because the Patriots and the Steelers, So I want to welcome the program, former New England Patriot and Insightful Player, Jarvis Green. Jarvis, thanks for calling, man.
Hey, thank you very much. How you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic, and I tell you, Jarvis, it's an amazing thing to look at how many Patriots I've interviewed compared to Steelers. If I could get these high-profile, like I had Matt Light on my show, I've had you on the show, if I can get those types of level players that have just played or are currently playing, what a fantastic thing. And to have someone who's a two-time Super Bowl champion and been in the Super Bowl 3 years, and you were there with the Pats, were probably the best team in the NFL, wouldn't you agree? They were your seasons with them. You were on this one of the greatest teams ever, right?
Yeah, I agree. You know, with the new day and age of football, and with the way the franchise is set up compared to back in the day when you had guys play for, you know, steady teams for 8 to 10 years in their whole career, 03 and 04, that back to back year had to be something special, and it had to be. You know, while it was very hard for us to accomplish that, you know, with today's football the way it is.
Absolutely. But we got to go to the story, because that's what the Insightful Players bring, is a story. And basically, you wouldn't have been as great as you were if it wasn't for your parents. So you definitely thank your parents for this journey to the NFL, wouldn't you agree?
I would agree. Humble beginnings, you know, just growing up, small town of Donaldsonville, Louisiana, and from day one, my parents always make sure that we do things 100% and we give it our all. You know, at the same time, having family values, and you know, just started the off and just praying and giving thanks, you know, to God, and just moving forward and always having a positive attitude about whatever we do in life.
Absolutely. And through that process, your brother, your twin brother, really helped you in the process. Jason, tell us a little bit about that and kind of pushing you forward.
Oh, man, Jason, that's funny. He texted me earlier today. He works at Shell oil company out here. And I'm sorry, he works for Exxon Oil Company in Chalmette, Louisiana. And that's my twin brother. We're a minute apart. My mom had a C-section, and I remember my mom said she had some dreams, and when she knew that she was pregnant, she was going to get an abortion. You know, but she had a dream with her dad, and her dad pretty much, she said that my mom is very, very spiritual, and she's a preacher also, preach ministry. And then she was like, hey, her dad said, hey, Marion, don't do the abortion. You know, these two boys, they're going to give you hell, but it's going to be a great outcome, you know. So all my life, me and my brother, I mean, we fuss, we fight. But at the end of the day, you know, we got each other backs, and we grew up in it. Just every day was a battle between us and between, I guess, the world, whoever we was facing, you know. So, but we always had each other back and just pushing each other all the way from birth, all the way through, you know, middle school, high school, went to college together, played football, college together. We've been roommates all our lives, you know, up to date. So very special, my brother Jason.
Okay, and it's a surprising situation that he really pushed you a lot of times, right? To get in shape,
Well, I tell you this, to this day he pushes me because I go do my different things in business, and he always the guy that he pushed my buttons, and sometimes he upsets me most of the time. I know he means well, and that's the love of a brother or a sister. And it's special for us, you know, because we have our fusses, we have our fights, you know, but we always brothers. And at the end of the day, if we need each other, we'll be there for each other. And he really opened my eyes up for a lot of things, you know, because a lot of times I always tell him, hindsight 2020, man, you can see what I go through. And at the same time, you know, you always have, you know, everybody has an opinion, you know, but I tell you, when my opinion comes from my twin brother, oh, my goodness. It is crazy. I tell you that personally.
And so he pushed you, but then basically you're becoming a great athlete. We have a lot of different stories. But in school, you dealt with some hard times. You were picked on in school, but you fought back. But that got you in a lot of trouble, didn't it?
It did. It did. I mean, I was just the way we grew up. And then I know I always got teased by the kids and just, you know, tough times. I guess a part of having just being, you know, being bullied. You know, I was a little guy. I wasn't the big guy that you see on the football field knocking people around, but I was a little guy. I had a growth spurt when I was in from the 8th to the 9th grade, but I always got picked on, but I always fought back. And that's one thing, you know, my dad always say, you know, if you didn't start the fight, when you say, if somebody pick on you, you got to show them you're toughness. Now, for me, I think I did it too many times because I remember that one year I got put out three times. I had one more time to get put out, and I would have been expelled for the year and would have been held back. And right there, then and there, I had to make a decision at an early age. I was in, third grade. And from that point on in my life, I had to make that decision and, you know, serious decisions. And, hey, it worked out for the best.
Okay, and it definitely worked out for the best. We're talking to Jarvis Green, insightful player, great NFL player for the New England Patriots, and we're learning about
his
life.
Don't say that.
No, see, I trust me, I had Baltimore Ravens on too, Jarvis. You're about to fall over, right? Especially in a Pittsburgh station, having a Raven on, and a tremendous person, Daniel Wilcox, we had on last week. But
great guy.
Everyone insightful players. Chrissy's awesome. Fantastic. So when we're going into the whole situation involving you're fighting back, it got you in trouble and you were becoming a juvenile delinquent, but your parents stepped in to make sure that this didn't continue, right? Because this would have led you to a really bad situation and never having those opportunities.
I think so. Could have been down here for me, but I remember my dad said there, it was myself, it was my dad, it was the principal. And we had, I guess it was the person, the guy from the juvenile home. My dad looked at me and said, hey, you either go fight again, go with this guy. I'm tired of whipping you. I'm tired of chastising you. It's your third time. You made the decision. That was it.
And you made the right decision, which is fantastic, Jarvis. You wouldn't be where you're at today. And I deal with this a lot of times with kids I tutor and that make the wrong decisions. And it's really sad. And it's great, again, showing how important parents are to really step in, especially before things big time happen. But then we get into seventh grade and we get into football. And Jarvis, as you said before, you think you're such a giant of a man. But in seventh grade, you weren't. And football was a little challenging at first for you, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I mean, I had some older brothers that played collegiate football, and we looked up to them all the time. But we were supporting them, and they were our heroes, you know. So what else could we do but play football? But then when I went out my first day in the seventh grade, got all my uniform, everything put together, did all that stuff, and got out there and started tackling and going up against this guy about twice the size of me. And he was my cousin. He was a fullback, and I'm sitting there and like, so y'all want me to tackle this guy? Go up on a little sled and hit him, and he ran completely over me, helmet turned sideways. I'm looking through my ear hole, mouthpiece almost choked down my mouthpiece, and I'm like, oh no! I got up and took my helmet off, threw my helmet off. I said, I'm done. I quit. And I walked to the showers, and my coach came back in, and he said, hey, Green, I'm not going to let you off that easy. Anybody can quit. Anyone. Was it even hard for you to walk off? He said, I said, no. He said, look, because he coached my older brothers. He said, you're going to get your butt back out here. You're going to line back up. You're going to go against this guy again. And it was probably a 20-minute conversation in the locker room. And, you know, his name was Coach Rabler. He rest in peace. And I got to say, that changed my life completely. Completely. So from that day on, I've never quit anything I ever tried to do in life from that day.
And how did that, I mean, a lot of times authority figures, people jump on them and say, forget it, I'm not going to listen to them. Would you say your character growing up from your family helped you to understand
yes.
Coach and say, I'm going to listen to Coach, and I'm glad Coach did
yes.
this and kicked my butt?
Yes, that's coming from the house, my mom and dad. That's where that came from. Because I always respect authority figures, respect teachers, and, you know, and I always was that guy. I was a good kid. I mean, I got in fights, got, you know, kicked out of school. I mean, as far as, you know, just expelled from school. But I always was a good kid. I respected my teachers, respected my elders, and I listened to them, you know. And when somebody sit there and pushing you and asking you to come back, you know, he wasn't begging me. He was telling me.
Yeah, and understand completely. What a story so far with Jarvis. We're talking to Jarvis Green. Now, I guess you're constantly in kind of a battle, a struggle. I mean, like everyone that deals with different things, and then your parents divorce. And that's got to be really hard on you because your family niche and how you, with your twin brother and the fact of how close you guys were, to see this happen, it could have spiraled you downward, but it didn't.
No, it didn't. I mean, it was really tough. I mean, from the time my mom and dad divorced, my mom been living, she lives with me, you know, all the way through college. And when that happened, I didn't go to the prom. I didn't do all these things everybody do in high school. Just didn't have opportunity, you know, but I had an opportunity to go to work. And I remember working in Winn-Dixie because I was trying to help her to keep the lights on so we could have, you know, warm, you know, hot water. And it was tough. It was tough. I mean, we saw everything, but it really, really started to really kick in, I would say, as we got into college, you know, because we didn't have both parents at all the different events and the things that we did. So it was really hard because I was sitting there trying to, you know, keep my dad happy, sit there and keep my mom happy, you know, us rebelling against my dad and faith, you know, just that's all you know, growing up in the household and then doing everything together. So that's when it really was complex. And for us, had to go to school still, had to graduate, had to go to college and make these decisions. But I know it really, I saw life a lot different.
You definitely saw life a lot different, Jarvis, and you said to yourself, man, this is something I got. And by working hard and doing all these different things, that work ethic led you to be great on the football field as well, correct?
Yes, it did. I just had that that no-quit effort, you know, just fighting. Because I know for me, I mean, I fractured my – I had a bad car accident when I was in high school. not high school, my freshman year in college. And I remember just going through that and the pain and had a broken back and played football, had to deal with everything. I mean, every time I come back to my apartment, my mom was there, so she was going through her stuff, you know, right from fresh off of divorce. And that's all I heard all day, all day. So a lot of times, you know, I had to go in different places to have my quiet time just so I could keep my books together, you know, and also with football. So I know at a young age, at 18, 19 years old, I think I was taking on the world. For as most kids, you know, getting up, going to school, they had their jobs, whatever, they went to class and went home, I went back to the apartment. Not to deal with a mom that just went through a divorce and had to deal with that and paying bills and just a lot.
So you grew up very quickly in